Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to season 4 of the Treasures from Malta podcast, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast, I meet even more of Malta's living treasures. I meet artists, collectors and historians with some Malta connection, and we have conversations about their life in art. My guest today is a poet and a philosopher who has a tendency to look east. He has mastered the difficult language of Sanskrit and has studied and written extensively about it. He draws lessons from the great philosophical traditions of the East and finds connections with that of the West, using the East as his starting point. He has translated and adapted into Maltese a number of texts, including several for the theatre, and he continues to lecture on both Western and Eastern philosophy in various institutions, including the University of Malta, where he is professor. He has, in fact, been involved in academia throughout his life. He set up the philosophy department at Junior College. He co-founded the Malta Classics Association, where he also served as president. He is a member of various boards, and he was instrumental in setting up the Systems of Knowledge course for pre-university students. He was one of the founding members of Philosophy Sharing, that has now become the University Philosophy Department's outreach, taking the philosophical conversation to the general public. His publications are endless, and his research is ongoing, including participating in international organizations such as his membership of the Scientific Board of the Elemir Zola International Research Society. Michael Zamit, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Michael, where did you grow up, and were you drawn to philosophy at an early age?
I was born in Valletta. In 1954, way back. Valletta was a totally different city then. So I grew up in the Valletta of the 60s and the 70s. And the first time I came across the word philosophy was when I was about 10. And I had no idea what it meant. I had to go to the dictionary to find out. Because some person had lent me a book and I saw this word there and it seemed quite attractive. Then I forgot all about it. And it was about almost 10 years later that I came back to philosophy in quite an odd way, actually.
How is that?
I read architecture to start with. I entered the architecture course in 1970. And I followed architecture for 2.5 years. I passed for my third year, but I was dismayed because I discovered that it wasn't what I really wanted to do. At that point in time, the Department of Architecture at first attracted us by presenting us with a degree and as Bachelor of Architecture, an architecture degree, which was really new at the time. But then a few years later, they wanted to change it to become Architecture and Engineering, as it had been before. And I refused. I didn't want to do that. So what did I do? So I was going to drop out, and then I was approached by the new head of Department of Philosophy, who was Professor Peter Seracino Glod, whom I had met earlier in a totally other circumstance, related to poetry, actually. But we might speak of that later.
Absolutely.
And he said, look, I noticed that you're going to quit architecture. Why don't you join the philosophy department. I said, no way, I do not want to start again. I want just to get out of here and to do something else. He said, no, we really need lay people to join the philosophy department because so far it's been inundated by priests-to-be.
I see.
That was what he said.
I see.
And that really struck me. I mean, I still was not convinced. So then he said, why don't you join in the second year of the department since you have, you know, architecture and mathematics would be your optionals, which you've already covered, and you can join as a second year student. And I accepted that. And I never looked back.
But look, we're talking about philosophy here. In a nutshell, and I'm talking about really one or two sentences, what is philosophy?
Oh, yes. I have no idea, actually. I'm still trying to find out. Well, the word is obvious. People know what the word means. There is love and there is wisdom in the word. Sometimes it's described as the love of wisdom. Sometimes it might even be described perhaps as the wisdom of love. But certainly wisdom and love are two aspects of the human being, and our nature can manage. There is our reasoning powers, there is our feeling powers, there is our activity. We are sort of tripartite creatures. Now, when I reason in one way and I feel differently, then there is a crisis. I suspect that philosophy was created as a means to try and resolve that crisis, so that what I am is in harmony with what I feel.
Okay. Now, another difficult question. What is the essential difference between Eastern and Western philosophy?
Oh, essentially, none.
Great.
Because they are both, if we can speak of both, because in my eyes, I do not distinguish between Eastern and Western philosophy. You know, Eastern and Western are very relative terms. Mm-hmm. When I was in Bali, Europe was Western. From Malta, Bali is Eastern. Mm-hmm. But it's all relative. If you go to Australia, Bali becomes Western. Mm-hmm. And so on. So that is very relative. But wherever human beings are to be found, there is always this, as we were saying just now, this relationship between what they think, what they feel, and what they do. And this relationship has always got to be harmonized. Mm-hmm. But there is also what they are as related to others and what they are as related to the creation and the cause of the creation. So philosophy tries to juggle all these concepts, if you see what I mean.
Okay, so you say that Eastern and Western philosophy, essentially there's no big difference between them, but you've studied both.
Yes.
And the university units you've taught include classical period philosophy, philosophy of the Western Renaissance, but also ways of thinking of the Far Eastern people.
Yes.
Wrapped up in all of this is religion and spirituality. Hinduism and Buddhism cannot be divorced from philosophy, as I've seen even from the courses you've given. Now, this seems to me to be quite a vast spread.
Yes.
Is there a particular branch of philosophy that you are really drawn to, that kind of resonates with you as an individual?
Yes. Yes, there is. And this particular branch is my fascination of trying to answer the question as to how can one be the best version of oneself.
Okay. Is there a name to this branch of
philosophy? One can call it ontology, the realm of ontos means in Greek being, so one is asking what is it to be a human being. Mm-hmm. One can call it linguistic philosophy as well, because our being is best expressed in the manner in which we communicate. And that is not just by speaking, but also by dressing, eating, and looking at others, and walking, and so on. All these are our means of communication and others. And of course, this is what I define as the spiritual realm. You see, as human beings, there is our physicality, there is our thought, our psychology, our minds, but then there is also the cause of that. And this is what really we are, our being, and this is our spirituality.
So philosophy actually truly touches every aspect of human life.
Yes.
So you've lectured to nursing students. You've looked as well at aspects of dying. So, you know, this is the physicality of the human body as well.
Yes.
But does philosophy enter into, for example, the practice of yoga and dance? Do they stem from or they feed off philosophy too?
Yes, if we consider philosophy as being this attempt at discovering, as I said, the best version of oneself in contemporary European continental philosophy, sometimes this is called authenticity, being authentic to oneself. Well, if that is the case, then all that the human being does is related. Obviously, ultimately, basically, it is a form of speaking. And so one can devise manners and ways of expressing one's finest qualities in all these ways. Dance. So there is a philosophy of dance, of course. The practice of meditation. Mm-hmm. And the practice of meditation is, as it says, a practice, a manner for feeding not merely the mind and the stillness of the mind, but the causality of it, the spirituality, the being. All these ways of doing art, I would say, are forms of yoga.
Now, in fact, you mentioned art, and I want to bring you around to the visuals. Amongst the many offshoots of philosophy, you have taught calligraphy to architecture students. Now, that detail fascinated me. Firstly, why do architecture students need to be taught calligraphy, which is the art of decorative handwriting? And what type of calligraphy were you teaching, and how on earth does it relate to philosophy?
Yes, yes. I discovered the practice of calligraphy a long, long time ago, and I had some fine teachers showing me how to sit down at a board with pen and ink, practice straight lines falling down the page, and then turning them into circles, and then gradually forming letters, and obviously creating illustrations to illuminate those words. And what I had discovered in that practice was that the attention can be centered. The attention can be centered and can be put right where the nib touches the page. And that is where the ink flows. And as the attention is centered in that way, what one reaps is an interest, not merely in what one is writing, but in the stillness that one can be writing from. So this very simple act of creating words on a page in an aesthetic way becomes the dance of the line that expresses the depth of feeling of the writer and the causality of that feeling, which is ultimately stillness. And therefore, I would say that calligraphy is necessary not only to architecture students, but to any student whatsoever who is interested in working from a point of stillness in order that they may embrace and investigate the questions that arise in their studies.
So it's, in a way, a vehicle for meditation.
It is a practice of meditation, yes. And I believe that in the Middle Ages, when monks practiced calligraphy, they didn't just merely practice copying texts. They also practiced the spiritual aspect of it, which provided them with the silence and the stillness that is required for that activity mm-hmm. to become a fine activity. And this is the issue with most arts, isn't it? Painters do this, dancers do this.
I mean, we reduce it to a few words, but I think it really encapsulates this. We call ourselves as being in the zone when we're producing a work of
yes,
art.
Yes, nowadays this is the phrase
that is being used. It actually means the same thing.
Yes, footballers do this. They mm-hmm. feel in the zone and exactly. then they practice magic mm-hmm. with their legs and the ball.
Yes, you've tuned in to that higher mm-hmm. feeling where you're at one with your art.
Yes, and then the physicality of it, mm-hmm. the psychology of it, and the spirituality of it, mm-hmm. the causality of it, start to function in a harmonious way.
Yes. And why architecture students in particular?
Well, it wasn't in particular for architecture students. Mm-hmm. When I taught calligraphy, it was as a subject in what in those days was known as the foundation studies course. And we had students who had a standing year. They were waiting to join architecture, medicine, dentistry, whatever. And many of the architecture students, of course, were naturally sort of inclined to this, since it involved boards and pens and rulers. But it wasn't just for them. We had all sorts of other students doing it.
Now, Michael, university courses in philosophy might seem very daunting and so cut off from ordinary life, but bridging this gap between this very lofty subject and mundane life is the School of Practical Philosophy. Tell me about it.
Yes, the School of Practical Philosophy is a fascinating experiment. It started in Malta in the 60s. I joined in the late 60s, I joined in the early 70s, I was still a student then, and it involves, as it says, the practicality of trying to offer people not just the theory of philosophy, not just the ideas, but also tools as to how to go about making those ideas available in one's life. So it brings this aspect, this meditative aspect into the picture. Mm-hmm. And in the School of Practical Philosophy, what is offered is the theory. Mm-hmm. And usually that theory is connected with philosophies such as Renaissance philosophies, Marsilio Ficino, but also and particularly with ancient Upanishadic philosophies. Sanskrit philosophies,
sure, we'll come to that,
and it was in that domain that I came across the structured study of the Sanskrit language, okay. which actually changed very many things for me, because it started giving me insight into not only what I do and how I relate to the world and others, but also into who one might be before being human. This was always a question that sort of was ticking in my mind. We are human, and that is fine, that is brilliantly fine, that is extraordinary, and we've got all these assets, but what supports our humanity? And then I discovered that this was also the question of Ludwig Wittgenstein. He was always trying to ask this very basic question: what does it mean to be human? What is it to be human? And then I discovered also that this was the philosophy that was being promoted by the ancient Sanskrit texts, particularly the conversation between Arjuna, a warrior, and Krishna, his charioteer.
Let's talk about Sanskrit then. Now, amongst the many languages that you're proficient in, you can speak Sanskrit. Now, just to go by the dictionary definition of Sanskrit, it is an Indo-European Indic language in use since around 1200 BC, but this is contested by other sources that I found. Yes. The fact is it's very ancient.
It's very ancient.
It yes. is the religious and classical literary language of India.
Yes.
Apparently one of the very oldest languages still spoken in the yes. world. Except that it isn't really mainly spoken in India. It is one of India's many official languages, but mainly spoken in religious ceremonies and in a few areas of India.
Yes, this is in the Indian context. But uh-huh. Sanskrit originally wasn't even called Sanskrit. It was called just merely speech. The word they used was Bhasha, which means speech. Mm-hmm. And it was the speech, to call it that way, of a group of nomadic tribes that lived between Russia and what is now Europe, and between Finland and the Himalayas. Later on, these tribes, they were known, they called themselves Aryan. Mm-hmm. Aryan means civilized in Sanskrit, mm-hmm. basically. But it's the name where we get the word Iran from.
And it's and the Aryan people, of course.
The Aryan people, Iran. And it's the word where we get Iray. The Irish call their country Iray, which means Aryan. And these are all the places where these people settled. Mm-hmm. These tribes started settling. One of the places where they settled was in the north of India. They crossed the Himalayas and entered India. They settled there. They started forgetting their traditional speech mm-hmm. and the speech in which they had coined their medicine, they had their medical practice and knowledge. They coined their artistic practice and knowledge. They coined their general spirituality knowledge, the Upanishad, the epics. When they settled, when they started settling in the north of India, they started forgetting this speech. Mm-hmm. And so then they devised the writing of it. And that is when Sanskrit started to be called Sanskrit.
Because it's codified into a language which has a written record at that stage.
Yes, at that stage it starts to be written down.
But let's talk about you.
Yes.
Why did you learn Sanskrit?
Well, I came across Sanskrit because we were investigating the Upanishadic philosophies, the philosophies of these very ancient poetico-philosophical, I would say, mm-hmm. texts. They're very ancient, the Upanishad and the original Indo-European. By Indo-European, we mean Indian and European. Mm-hmm. These ancient mythical texts, and in Sanskrit, they're codified. They are written down entirely. So we were examining these and needing to examine the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, it wasn't enough to just read them in translation. Then I discovered that Sanskrit is the mother language of ancient Greek and Latin, and therefore all the European languages that are not Semitic
were derived from it.
Are related to it. You can take any word in English, take it back to Latin or to Greek, and then take it back to its Sanskrit origin. And there you find extraordinary things happening. Because the way that Sanskrit was codified was not like a normal grammar. Sanskrit was codified like a software language. What we call the grammarians of Sanskrit weren't actually entirely logical. Yes,
logical.
Entirely logical. The master, we would call him the master grammarian, but he would call himself, or his students would call him, the master deconstructionist of the language. That's what they call it in Sanskrit, Vyakarana, which is unfortunately translated as grammar. His name was Parnini. He lived something like 400 BC, and he codified this language and wrote possibly the first most famous software language ever.
Incredible, incredible.
And just recently, in this past month, there was one aspect of Panini's grammar which had always been causing difficulty, mm-hmm. because it was being misinterpreted. And therefore, because of the misinterpretation, words weren't being created properly. But a student of Cambridge just a few weeks ago reinterpreted this code, mm-hmm. and suddenly the whole thing fell
into place. Amazing.
So that now we can teach our laptops, mm-hmm. how to generate Sanskrit words.
And it makes sense. Now that was the key to unlock all this.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes.
Which shows that the human mind really thinks in the same way through the centuries, through the millennia.
Yes. Yes. And through the cultures.
Across cultures. So there is a linking factor in the way we think.
Yes.
That is,
I did have a student about 15, 20 years ago, and she had sort of got this feeling.
Mm-hmm.
She came to class and was telling me, look, these software languages, they are like the Sanskrit we're considering in class.
And incredible. But Michael, you were studying Sanskrit, you were analyzing Sanskrit already at MA level, and this is in the 90s, pre-internet days.
Yeah.
Now, you were studying at the University of Malta, where the resources obviously were quite limited.
Yes.
Nobody had studied Sanskrit,
yes.
at university level. So how were you finding your resources? You didn't have the internet to help you. Books were in translation. How do you go about studying this language, which was not being taught by anybody locally?
Locally, no. But yes, I came. I at first I was doing it alone. I started doing it alone, and then I had a bit of teaching.
But alone on the basis of books, presumably.
On the basis of books, yes.
Teach yourself
and then,
Sanskrit.
Yes. And then at the School of Practical Philosophy, we were advised to start to study Sanskrit in a rather more serious way. And so groups were created investigating Sanskrit thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these groups used to meet in Oxford and in other places in England, and I used to attend regularly.
I see.
And I started coming in touch with this, mm-hmm. knowledge, and it just started developing in, mm-hmm. a magnificent way.
Can you speak fluently, or is it easier to write?
I can't speak fluently, no, not as such, but I can quote shlokas, I can quote verses from from the Upanishads.
Uh-huh. And you have in fact translated the Upanishads.
And I have translated
some... Or I should say Upanishads.
Some, uh-huh. Upanishads, yes. Mm-hmm. And I translated the Bhagavad Gita, which is one chapter of a huge mythical epic.
Now, you've translated them into Maltese.
Yes.
What was the reason for that? I mean, your audience is going to be extremely limited. I presume,
yes.
there was no point in translating them into English because it's been done. But into Maltese, what relevance do they have for the contemporary Maltese person?
What I translated is a conversation between Arjuna, who is a warrior, and his uncle, who decides not to practice, not to take part in the war, but to be his charioteer. And this was an internecine war, a war between cousins. So it had been coming for a long, long way. And at one point, Arjuna asks his charioteer, Krishna, to take him into the center between the armies that were gathered, ready for war. And when he sees his teachers as his enemies, he sees his cousins as his enemies, he sees his relatives as his enemies, Arjuna breaks down and loses just all his energy and has this massive nervous breakdown. He decides he'd rather commit suicide and lose the war and not participate. And then he asks Krishna to advise him about this. And Krishna starts this magnificent conversation to bring him out of this torpor that he had broken down into. And very quickly, the conversation turns into how the human being can be brought out of this situation, which is a situation not merely historical, as Arjuna was facing, but also individual, where the human being is facing
crisis.
demons in himself, crisis in his life. And so the conversation becomes a universal philosophical conversation. And I think that is relevant to any human being, particularly the Maltese, who, when I was translating this stuff in the 80s and in the 90s, I could see very clearly that they were entering into a very dark place.
Yeah.
Which, of course, now we are finding ourselves in. The country is in a dark place. And so it is conversations of this nature that can possibly
give clarity
not just to our actions and not just to our minds, but to our state of being.
Yes, I can see that. I can see that.
That's how it works. The translation of Sanskrit into Maltese was also a means for me to examine the relationship between the Indo-European world of languages and the Semitic world of languages.
Fascinating. Now that is
for me, that was very important, because our Maltese minds are working with these two worlds.
And did you find connections?
Well, connections, not linguistic connections, but yes.
Okay.
When translating from the Sanskrit, one had to, first of all, enter into the Sanskrit notion, into the Sanskrit word and the concept that is being translated, and then re-examine that in terms of a Semitic language, which functions in a different way from the Sanskrit way.
Ironically, this must have happened in India, if you look at the history of India.
Sure, the Arabs, this was when you're replicating that in a way. In myself.
Let's take a break.
Yes.
And we'll come back to find out more.
Good.
This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, philosopher and poet Michael Zammit. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Now, Michael, you're a poet, a published poet. What is your poetry about?
Oh, that's a very difficult question to answer.
I ask difficult questions for a living.
Interesting. The first time I ever wrote a poem, it was a poem of convenience. I was 12 and there was an advert on one newspaper which said that if you won a poetry competition, you could get books, 6 books. And it was the time when I wanted to read all the books in the world. So that was very attractive. So I decided to write a poem. Conveniently. And
No doubt you won that competition,
yes,
Michael.
But the poem was about the death of God.
Oh.
God committing suicide.
Oh, it was accepted.
It was accepted and it was
published even.
And it was called Deicide. It won the competition. And I received a telephone call
from your parish priest.
Ominously from someone who asked for Michael, and when he heard my voice, I was about 12, 13, he asked me, how old are you? And I said, I'm 13. And then there was a great big silence, and he said, can I speak to your dad? And then he came home. That man was Peter Saracino Nglot.
Oh.
He came home. Later, much later, he told me that he had prepared 6 books for the winner of this competition, but he had to change them when he discovered that I was 12. So I ended up having, you know, I won Alice in Wonderland and The Little Prince and books like that.
Well, key texts.
Yes, key texts. Yeah. Very, very beautiful texts. Now, so when you ask me what is your poetry about, I suspect that it is always related to how human beings are predominantly creative with not merely what they say, but how they say it, the manner in which they speak. And I can see that there has always been a very, very significant element of sound sensitivity mm-hmm. in the manner in which I write the poetry. They were always meant to be spoken.
Do they approach music?
Well, yes, that interface between music and diction and mm-hmm. things spoken mm-hmm. is where the poetry which I express explores.
Mm-hmm. Talking about sound, your poems have been described as being like mantras, that their sound lulls you into a meditative state. Yes. Is that a consideration when you're writing them, when you're drafting the words? And let's hear one of them.
I'm not sure whether it's a consideration. It's like something that was cultivated. Mm-hmm. Well, when I was translating the Bhagavad Gita, it took the best part of 20 years to finish. But at that time, my Sanskrit was rather primitive, so I was going into words and listening to them and repeating them to myself and sounding them. And this had an effect on the mind. Mm-hmm. And then after a period of working with that, with the Sanskrit, and attempting to understand the Sanskrit in the Maltese language, I would stop and take a break or mm-hmm. go off somewhere. And then I started to discover that at certain points when I was away from doing this, I started hearing verses which were predominantly in Maltese, but sometimes used words which were not used in Maltese. Mm-hmm. So there were these words coming to mind, and I started them almost jokingly, mm-hmm. putting them down in writing. And that's how it started to emerge, this appreciation of the sound element. And the whole system of poems, a cycle called Annalena came about like that. Annalena translates as odes to bliss.
Yes.
Or songs of bliss or something like that. And then a mantric system. Well, the mantric system is called Mereddin in Maltese, mm-hmm. which is the word I coined to mean a mantra. These Maltese mantras, recently I have these don't get translated. You have to rehear them. Mm-hmm. So I was working in the last approximately 5 years or so, rewriting these mantras.
Let's hear one of them.
Doing with Maltese and trying to find the English sound mm-hmm. for it. So, for example, and there is a whole series of them. So one of them would read like this. A universe cast into a rapid look taken, bound within a heart, a searing glimpse of dawn, a lightning for you, afar, for a universe cast into a rapid look taken, bound within a heart, a searing glimpse of dawn, a lightning for you, afar, for a universe cast into a rapid look taken, bound within a heart. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because the pacing of the words is totally different. I was trying to read them before when we were off mic, and I was reading them as sentences. I was trying to give them the sense of sentences. Your reading of them is completely different, and I can understand now why they're more mantric in the sense that kind of it stops and starts, and there's a rhythm to them that is divorced from the actual sense.
Yes.
It's almost, there is no particular sense that you can give them. They're almost abstract.
It's more like a feeling that starts to emerge. As one repeats it, a feeling starts to emerge.
That is what you're aiming for,
That is principally the idea. Because when feelings are genuine, they are, their center is always a very deep silence. And that is what matters.
A silence is an absence, though. Isn't it a void?
Well, there are, you know, I mean, what Sanskrit taught me is that there are different forms of silence. Yes, there is a type of silence which is an absence, and that is the silence of the grave. There is a silence which is active, like when one is reluctant to say something which they ought to say.
It's a pregnant pause.
It's a pregnant pause. And then there is a silence which is creative. And that is what this poetry wants to touch. That silence before a painter puts the first spot of color on their blank canvas.
So you mentioned Anna Lena, which were a collection of poetry which you published in a book form in 2005, and in fact this links up very nicely to Patrimonio because you launched the book of poetry at Palazzo Falzon in collaboration with Patrimonio. Now, they are Maltese and they consist of actually one poem. The whole book is one poem made up of 35 cycles.
Yes.
Now, according to the blurb, this is what is said. It finds its roots in an ancient philosophical tradition that spans the striving after wisdom and the love of it by both West and East. Now, Michael, to express philosophy and such big themes in poetry seems to me to be kind of an added layer of difficulty. Who are you writing for? And are you looking inwards and writing to resolve your own philosophical doubts? Or do you write to reach out, to debate, perhaps even to instruct your audience? Yes.
This work, Anna Lena, starts with a request. It asks the reader not to read these poems with their eyes, but to read them sotto voce, with their voices, to themselves. The idea is that this whole book can be read in 20 to 30 minutes, which I've done, and listened to, so that one is reading these. And what starts to emerge is physically the sounds that are being expressed, mentally the images that start to arise in the mind and in the feelings, and causally a very deep stillness.
So let's hear one of these poems from Anna Lena.
Loshrin. They don't have names, they have numbers.
Okay.
Ufiskit tadin el-jabra, inzel ijmar vdaun lainain, bishfilleha nilmhek tammar fkulimkin min fkulmnein inti.
Quite a mouthful, Michael. Not easy to actually read them out.
No.
I know, because we've tried more than once.
Yes.
And even you got stumped in one instance.
Yes.
Are you purposefully creating difficulties?
No.
Or are you just playing with language? You're inventing words as well here.
Yes, I'm just playing with it.
You're extending words that exist, but creating new forms for them.
Yes, no, I don't mean to be difficult in any way. It's just that I feel that the mind works with language, and if given the opportunity, and if given the impetus, it can start to transform words and find new forms.
Almost as though the brain is training the tongue how to speak these words.
Yes.
A bit like a dance. You don't get it right on the first try.
No.
So you have to keep trying.
It's a dance of sounds, yes. I like to see it like that.
Michael, let's look at your academic career now. And I'm going to remind you, or at least I remember well, that my first introduction to you was way back in my sixth form days. Oh. Now, I was a clueless 15-year-old, I think, when I had chosen philosophy A-level at St. Aloysius. Suffice to say that I didn't make a career of it. But I remember you teaching me logic.
I see.
And it was perhaps the only part of philosophy that really made sense to me. Again, perhaps because I liked maths and I liked physics, so somehow it felt like an extension of it. But, and this left a greater impact on me than logic did. In the late 80s, you also designed and implemented a change in the national curriculum that affected me directly. I can say that it actually changed the course of my life. Oh. And it showed me clearly for the first time that art was going to be my future.
Yes.
Now, tell me about systems of knowledge, this fantastic system that you had introduced. Lots of people were against it. They were very, very sort of resistant to it, including myself. But the minute we started studying it and we were exposed to it, you know, I came round completely.
Yes.
Why was it introduced, and what were you trying to address with it?
Father Peter, who was then acting as rector at the university, if I remember correctly, we had discussed this and how sixth formers need to start to come to terms with literature, with texts, with reading, and with other forms of knowledge as well.
Before they became doctors or architects, or they specialized
they
and
specialized,
just went down that route only. It gave us a background in the humanities, even if we were not going to pursue our studies in the humanities.
Yes.
Michael, in 2009 you published a book called Philosophy for Children.
Oh.
How do you think children can benefit from being taught philosophy, and at what age would you start them off?
At the School of Practical Philosophy, we had a class of children who were being introduced to very basic ideas of what beauty is, for example, what music does, for example. And this was done in a very down-to-earth way. So if we wanted to express a rather complex issue, the human heart, the love that expands towards all humanity, what would we do? We would take five-year-olds to the Malta Society of Arts, where there is a little hidden beautiful masterpiece by painting by Inglot, and show them the painting of this man with his light emanating from his heart. And then ask them what they make of this.
It's the altarpiece of the newly restored chapel at the Malta Society of Arts, which is at Palazzo della Sal in Republic Street. It's a fantastic piece of architecture, fantastic piece of painting, and a wonderful canvas of Anton Inglot, a modern artist in Malta.
It is magnificent.
It really is.
It's a hidden masterpiece.
His depiction of the spirituality was unparalleled.
Unparalleled, yes. Yeah. And children would see and look at this and then, you know, get them to speak about it. And the things they come up with is magnificent.
So even five-year-olds, you start them that early.
Six-year-olds, yes.
Okay. Yeah. If philosophy was compulsory for school children, do you think it would have a long-term impact on society?
I'm not sure. I don't know, really. Education structures are such, they're a very strange animal. With philosophy, what is fascinating and what always really struck me is that some of the greatest, but really the greatest work done in philosophy was always done outside these structures. So, for example, Nietzsche wrote his masterpiece, which defines his philosophy in a very deep way, when he was outside academia. And so did Wittgenstein. He never sort of fitted in with the academic system with the academic structures. And they wrote in poetry form. This is the amazing thing. Thus spake Zarathustra of Nietzsche is a poem. I read the Tractatus of Wittgenstein as a poem. And he wrote it with bullets whizzing around his head.
It's amazing. The art that comes out of the hardest possible situations for humans.
Yeah.
Sometimes an element of angst, I suppose, that really that sharpens your wit and sharpens your mind
and
to write down the essentials.
Yes, and helps you to
depict.
see something that others are not seeing.
Gives you that clarity.
Yes. Plato's philosophy was done when his teacher was ridiculed, killed.
Absolutely. Lots to think about there. Obviously, we're not advocating difficult situations. Quite the contrary. What I'm suggesting is that students should be exposed to philosophy so that it will result in a better future for all. But who knows? Michael, you're at present collaborating with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti on a major forthcoming project that will culminate in an exhibition called The Line in the spring. Tell me how you are bringing your take on the line, on the idea of the line, to what is essentially a visual art project.
Yes, the line. What a fascinating notion the line is. Well, where to start? The line can be a line that divides, but it can also be a line that brings people together. The line can become a wall, and that can be with or without windows, it can separate or it can
link.
It can
be a chain.
People together in the same room.
Michael, now we've talked a lot about Indian thought, traditions, and of course philosophy, but you haven't told me anything about Indian food.
Oh, yes.
What's your favorite Indian dish? And can you derive a philosophical lesson from it?
Well, I think that's the realm where my wife might be able to say much more about. In the Bhagavad Gita, when food is mentioned, the qualification is made that there are three types of food. There is food that produces torpor, produces anguish, and it is basically dead food, food that is preserved, and this
so difficult to digest, essentially.
A bit difficult to digest, yes, meats and so on. And then there is food that produces agitation, activity, and this is hot food, spicy foods, passionate results, with passionate results, it says, the Bhagavad Gita. And then there is food that is, they call it sattvic. Sattva is the quality of presence, the quality of light, the quality of life. And sattvic food is essentially food that ennobles the digestive system and the human life form, that is fresh, clean.
Such as vegetables.
Such as
perhaps?
Vegetables, fruits, and all forms of beans and things like that. Food that is very, very nourishing. Food that is alive. This is the qualification.
That doesn't require the killing of an animal.
That doesn't require the killing of an animal or any killing. And I think I like that type of food a lot. Yes, I personally feel very comfortable with that. Although I do like the hot, spicy foods as well.
But you're a vegetarian, so.
Yes, I am.
That's very commendable. And on that happy note,
Thank you, Michael.
I'm going to close off the podcast here. I do want to thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your philosophy, your understanding of Western and Eastern philosophy with us, and the clarity with which you express it, both in your poetry, in your thought, and in your speech. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.